Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Peter, for your wonderful Dharma talk.
Thank you, Kaz.
We worked on a book called A Flock of Fools. So we are trying to be a part of fools. We always try to tell stories about our foolish mistakes and so forth.
We never but, run out of material.
So we are happy to hear your thoughts about Peter's presentation, your questions about Peter's talk, also our Dogen Translation Project. So,
yeah, please don't don't feel you need to limit it to the talk. Just, you know, let's just talk about whatever is important to you.
I have a question about the distinction between language and. I have a question about the distinction between language and things, or language and not language, which you made in your talk. It seems that this is kind of a critical question, and I was curious about sort of the foundations of language and how you make the distinction between, or if there's a distinction between language and speech, or and language and writing, and things. So kind of putting those three things, and whether you see that there is a language of things, or within things, or in processes. So how you make that distinction.
So there's a language, also expression. Expression can be just a gesture, or smiling, or shouting, or doing nothing, that is larger than the language. And other than that, let's ask the poet.
Please forgive me for this, okay? Many years ago, I was taking a test to try to become a driver for United Parcel Service. And after 10 minutes, I realized that I didn't understand the questions. And so I brought my paper up to the proctor and said, here. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm handing in my paper. And he said, are you done? I said, well, I'm not done. I can't fill this out, so I have to give it back to you. And he said, are you abandoning the examination? I said, it's not so heavy, and I'm not abandoning it. I'm not abandoning anything. You know, I'm just handing in a paper because I don't know how to think that way. So the reason I'm saying it is that I don't fully understand some of the question, but the thing that you said in the latter part of your question, I thought it was very true and very beautiful. Is there a language of things? And my experience of life is that there is a language of things, that each thing has its own language, but that is what Kaz is calling expression. And so for me, it's trying to move, in engaging the world, to move through an engagement or an encounter with the expression of something, as if through speech, through language, right, to what's really behind it. That's what I'm always after. So I don't really make a distinction between like human language and stone language and tree language. We speak as humans and stones speak as stones. And I have to enter the world in which stones speak as stones in order to know what a stone is. That's my way of dealing with the language of things. As for, is speech different than language? And I don't really know. You know, I think speech tends to depend on expression mostly. So I'm sorry for such a poor answer, but that's what I have.
Thank you. I have two questions, if that's all right. The Shobo Genzo, I think already there are several complete translations in English. So one question is, do you expect that there will be more people who try and do complete translations of the Shobo Genzo? And secondly, when do you expect that something similar to the Shobo Genzo will be written in English?
Not in my lifetime. What do you
think? Maybe there are already like Soto text project. It's going on. It's a very important scholarly translations and annotations of the Shobo Genzo. So it's already happening. I mean, and also I hear about some Zen centers, you know, creating their own translations. Partially, maybe many translations, and fully, I think also there will be some more translations.
Great day. I wonder if Kaz might want to tell us a little bit about something predating the translation of Shobo Genzo into English, namely the edition which is in the room of your drawings, of your paintings, of your work bringing the original manuscripts of Dogen, as I understand it, into a more how you translated the original Japanese into another Japanese, into a more modern format.
In 1960, I asked a friend, Zen master, who was a great scholar, Soichi Nakamura. Would you translate Shobo Genzo into modern Japanese? There is no modern Japanese translation. Dogen is known as being so difficult, and it will be a great service if you would translate that into modern Japanese. And he said, yes, I will, if you help me. So that got me started. And I thought, I could help him for a few years and then do something more interesting. But I'm still doing that. We struggled. You know, we had a meeting one afternoon translating just one line and so forth. I didn't have any background on Buddhist studies or Chinese, Sanskrit. So we struggled, but by the end of 1960s, we published the entire Shobo Genzo in four volumes, plus Dogen Dictionary.
And can, just to follow up on that, can you typify in any particular ways the difference between the two? In other words, what is the original texts like that you found needed to be translated, and how were they different than the?
Well, the kind of medieval Japanese and then modern Japanese have different grammar and then a lot of different terms. So first we try to mechanically translate terms and then sort of put it in a modern syntax. But it didn't really work because, you know, you can't just sort of paraphrase. So we have to deconstruct the kind of syntax and terms and so forth, and then we invent some new terms for, such as like bodhisattva. We say kyudosha, which means seekers, or you know, something like that. It was difficult. It was impossible, but it was so much fun. Now we have, I think, 7 or 8 complete modern translations of Dogen.
Yes. You know, one thing your question brings up is, I think you used the word terms. So at times that Kaz and I would be translating, and it would say, then he had understanding. And I might say, did he have understanding, or did he understand? Did he have a understanding? Did he have the understanding? Or did he have realization? Did he have a realization? Did he have complete realization? And is this the same realization that we spoke about? No. You see? So to come to terms with the terms is an enormous, enormous task.
I liked how in your talk you quoted Suzuki Roshi very well when you referred to things as it is.
I wouldn't dare misquote him. Yeah.
Hello. Is this on?
Yeah.
What would you say to someone who's looking at different translations? For instance, the Genjo Koan, which I really enjoy reading. I can't read the original Japanese, and I have different English translations. I'm trying to figure out how to reconcile those different translations, because it seems like each word is so important. So I'm just curious what you would say to that.
If you only compare the titles, they are so different. I don't remember. Do you remember any translations of
the title?
Title?
Yeah. What is Nishijima's called?
But anyway, so different. I can really see that. You know, if I read other people's translation, then I may be stealing their translations unconsciously. So I usually don't read other people's translations. Mm-hmm. Genjo Koan, I did, yes.
Yeah. I don't know how to answer it. One thing that occurs to me is like if I'm working on a translation of something, I may have several different versions of that very same poem. One says it this way and one says it that way. At some point, I have to decide which direction to go into. That decision isn't necessarily made intellectually by comparing words. It's made in another way. And it may be, you know, you have to find the translation that works best for you in some kind of terms that you can't even really define for yourself. I don't think it's an academic decision. I think it's a different kind of decision. Something will speak to you more than something else. It's the only way I know how to address it.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask about, in your talk today, you were talking about the word mitsu, intimacy, mm-hmm. and closeness. And I'm really fascinated how Dogen often talks about the hair's breadth deviation and there being no gap. But then there's also this sense of, I loved the way the image of in your Dokusan with Maizumi Roshi, when you said that you could see only part of his face, but you know the rest is there, and just as in that image in the Genjo koan, mm-hmm. of being out on a boat and seeing the water and seeing it as round and knowing there's more there, and that sense of the gap, being, knowing that there's more there, being a sign of being part of understanding. And so there's that sort of tension between there being no gap and there being an understanding of a gap and fallibility, formal limitations, etc. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that?
Well,
apparent tension?
I feel like I've gone brain dead. Well, I would say that the gap is included in no gap. And so you shouldn't worry about the gap too much. Just draw closer. Okay, just draw closer, however you can. But you know, I mean, you know, the gap is part of no gap.
Right. And,
you know, so.
Can you say more about that, though?
I don't know. I thought that was a good answer.
I guess we'll keep talking about it all
day. Linda usually asks impossible questions.
Kaz and I have been working on this impossible project for exactly 30 years.
Yeah.
Different project, not Dogen. Uh-huh. This is something from Peter's talk that I want to ask about. You said you felt the warmth in this community, and
I did.
Dogen, you feel, is warm, even if some people might not get that right away.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like warmth was a good thing, the way you're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought for a second, and I thought, wow, warmth is live bodies, and we like that, and dead bodies are cold. But then you came to that poem, well, maybe it was the other order. You also had that poem of Dogen's, mm-hmm. which was your epigraph, where he was saying that he was enjoying the spring blossoming in the snow and the... Mm-hmm. The other way around. And that seemed to suggest that warmth and cold are always inside of each other and blossoming with each other. Mm-hmm. So that seemed fine to me as long as we knew that spring was coming.
Mm-hmm.
But that dead body is just cold, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So is there something good about warmth and something, some problem about cold, if we're not reading a great poem?
I live in Canada.
You can't get away from me that easily.
I couldn't sleep last night because it was so hot. It was so hot. No,
tell me about death. Is that a problem?
I'd like to live a long time and then I'd like to be dead a long time.
What's so good about warmth?
What's so good about warmth? Well, you know, we're warm. And our life is precious. And what's good about warmth to me is that it's about our life. And that life is not to be wasted in any way. And the reason that we feel differently when we see a cold dead body is because life is warm. And it's so important. And so even when we look at a cold dead body, I mean, like when I was with my father after he died, all I could feel was the warmth of the man. They were right there together in that exact same moment. And it wasn't that warm was good and cold was bad or life is good and death is bad. There wasn't anything like that. It was just, it was that place where everything existed exactly as it was. Live, I was alive, he was dead, I was warm, he was cold. But there was something else that I may not be able to name that held all of it as one life. And that's part of what I was trying to say in the talk as well. Just one life.
Okay. I have a question that's coming from Belfast, from Peter Doran. And he says, every translation is of its time. It speaks to its own time. Is there a particular voice that speaks to the world today?
We tried.
I think this is the time we are, you know, we face impossibilities of the environment and the violence and divisions. So we often tend to feel helpless, you know, and then maybe kind of passive and then maybe not engaging. So Dogen is so positive. He believes in the kind of power of action, even including the sitting and maybe centering on the sitting. Every action we take, however small it might be, will have an effect. Maybe a negative, you know, action will take, of course, negative effect, but positive, every positive action we take, if we could have a trust in kind of positive effect, I think that will be a very inspiring teaching by Dogen to our time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a couple questions if I could. The first one was the one I spoke about a little bit earlier. My basic understanding of Zazen and Zen practice is the idea of doing the sitting meditation, and you do that with mindfulness, and then you take that out into the world and you live with awareness and mindfulness. But it all comes down to this sitting, quiet meditation. So I think it's funny. I think it's great, but I think it's funny, and I think it's a paradox that there's this massive 1,500-page book that you guys just put together, and that Dogen wrote, you know, massive amounts. And I just, you know, isn't that a contradiction? If the Dharma comes from sitting, then why so many words? That kind of a thing. Pulling the Zen card.
The question has been responded to.
All right, second question. I've read some of the translation, and another thing that I find paradoxical and also kind of funny is Dogen, he reminds me of these rappers who have feuds with each other, and like, cause he'll say, "Oh, that guy's foolish. Don't follow his practice. He's wrong. Straight up. This is the unsurpassable way. This is the only way." But then again, I think, okay, but what about this idea of if rapper A is rapper B and rapper B is rapper A and we're all the same rapper, then why? then you know, why does he feel this need? Why do you think he may have felt the need to kind of call out these other people and basically, you know, name call them? And that doesn't seem, that was confusing to me.
You know, rapper A is not rapper B. first, ask their partners, they'll tell you. There's many ways to address the question. One is that Dogen was trying to clarify Dharma, and he would use many examples, even teachers and ancestors before him who he admired, but he would point out their shortcomings, because he wanted to try to elucidate the nature of Dharma and the nature of life itself, of things themselves. In the fullest way possible. So even when he would quote stories about previous teachers and ancestors, he would, and you'd think, that's it, that is the most fantastic thing, and then he knocks it down. And he knocks it down because he's trying to say, don't stop here. That's not enough. There's more to go. And this is actually what I loved about that part of Shobogenzo is that he's expressing confidence. in his students and his and now his readers. I know he never expected to have readers, of course, but he was expressing confidence in people that we could go all the way and that we didn't need to stop at any station until we actually went all the way in terms of realization and understanding. So for me, those stories are quite useful. And while it's true that Dogen can be pretty, let's say, critical in terms of the way he says it, the intention behind his saying it is actually, Linda, is part of the warmth that I find in Dogen. He cares that much. He cares so much that he's not willing to stop at anything, really, until the clarity of his realization could be known. To other human beings. So I hear those stories with a slightly different kind of ear than the way you're expressing.
His essays were delivered to his students, and maybe not so many people in this room, maybe about one quarter, maybe 10 people, 20 people. He was not thinking of kind of large readership, around the country, or he was not thinking of streaming around the world. So he was saying that, you have a genuine, the best Dharma. I tried in China, and then, it was awful. And then it was so corrupt. And then I could find a real teacher. And so he was saying, you don't have to waste your time kind of looking for other places and then other teachings. You got it, everything here. So that is, I think, the reason he was in such a small, intimate kind of environment. And then he was speaking to his students of a very small size.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I would like to just say one more thing about this. It occurred to me after about 7 years or so of working with Kaz on these translations, suddenly realized who was Dogen talking to? He wasn't talking to like Harvard graduates or, he was talking to the monks and who presented themselves at his temple. Farmers or farmers' children or, who knows how they got there. And yet, time after time after time, he was giving his absolute best to them, as Kaz is saying. He held nothing back from that. And when I look deeply at the nature of what he was saying, for example, his realization about women, and a cousin I talked about, I said, where in the world did he get that? It's not like he had support for the idea of equality or absolute equality of men and women in his culture, in his time, or anywhere else in the world at the time, or in any literature he may have encountered. I mean, where did it come from? And of course, it came from the fullness of his realization. That's where everything that has been translated has come from, was the fullness of his realization. And so that's so powerful. That's so very powerful that he would want to support it and he would want to present it, just as Kaz said, to say, this is really something that you should pay attention to.
Maybe.
Well, I don't think his students understood Dogen. Maybe one, Ejo, who was editing Dogen's writing in the way Ejo himself could understand, I guess. But otherwise, I don't think, he was addressing to us, mm-hmm. to the future mm-hmm. generations, I mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Peter, I just wanted to say I thought that was a fabulous Dharma talk. Really extraordinary. Okay, I'm very grateful. I heard Red Pine talk about translation once, and he said, well, some translators, it's like you're dancing with someone, and they're on the other side of the room, and you're kind of doing an interpretive dance. Mm-hmm. And then other translators, you're really up close, you know, kind of formal dancing. And he said something very much like what you said, I think, which is that he tries to see through the language to the original intention. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering just what that means, actually, when you're translating, and where you are in that dance.
Mm. So, Red Pine and I agree. We actually have talked about that a little bit. For me, I try to dance in both ways simultaneously. I feel great responsibility and obligation to the language that's been given to me. There are times that I might make a suggestion to Kaz about something, and he would just shake his head and say, Dolgen didn't say that. And he wasn't just talking about the meaning. It's just we have a language that we have to deal with somehow. So I feel I have to stay very close to that myself. However, to understand what that language, well, I'll say it a different way, to understand where that language came from, right, I have to go to the other side. I have to go outside of language to try, as I said in the talk, I don't remember what I said really, but to try to meet the place that gave birth to those words. And that means to try to meet Dolgen somewhere in the world of his understanding. I can't claim to have succeeded even for one syllable, but at least that's the general field in which I try to translate. I'm not someone who feels that it's fine to just interpret any way you want. I had a Polish edition of one of my books, and the translators got in touch with me and said, would you mind, in this poem you use the word eggplants, can we say potatoes? I said, no. They're eggplants. You know? They look very different than potatoes. And they said, well, most people in Poland don't know about eggplants. I said, well, okay, that's not going to be my problem. You know, eggplants. You know, so.
First thing, I want to thank you both enormously for your dedication and work on this enormous gift to all of us. Your publication is coming out simultaneously with UC Press's release of Mark Twain's work. Oh. And I just attended 100 years after his death, which was his request. And I just attended a talk on the editor's release of the piece over in Berkeley a couple nights ago. And he said, he showed us a copy of the New York Times bestseller list and said that they were all amazed that as of tomorrow, it's the Twain work is going to be number 2 on the bestseller list and right behind John Stewart's book on Living on Earth. And although I don't expect Dogen necessarily to enter that list, number 3, we never know. I'm definitely open to it. I'd like to ask both of you the same question that I asked that editor, which, the first thing I asked him was, what do you make of this great popularity in these modern times of Mark Twain? And I think you've addressed that about Dogen very well. But I also asked him, with the intimacy of the translating work that you've done, bringing yourselves so close next to the warmth of Dogen, I'd like to ask you both as artists if how translating Dogen has affected your work as artists and as people. How did it change you, or how did it affect what you do in the world?
I don't know. Does Peter know?
Make a guess.
I think that makes me help enjoy each moment more fully. Each line I draw more fully. You know, just enjoy, just being there, and just being happy.
Yeah, I would just say that I feel I can't even tell you how grateful I am to have been allowed to work with Dogen all this time. And so that gratitude really just spreads. And it's not like I was ungrateful before, but you know, some big brushstroke of gratitude has really moved through my life, and I feel it. And I just try to live that way, and it's really rooted in this work with Dogen.
One last short question. One more question.
Any closing remarks?
It's so wonderful to see you here. I'm fully grateful that Zen Center here, and then we are all together.
Yeah, just thank you so much for coming and helping to celebrate this wonderful event. And live well.
Well, thank you so much. Just the way you hold this subject matter simultaneously so lightly and joyfully, and let its profundity bring you to a place beyond words. It's just the way you do that. It's a wonderful teaching. Thank you so much.